right. The TV crew tells me we're up and running, so everybody come to order. This is the November 17th, 2011 Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting, and I'd like to let you know that our chair, Joe Costello, is just temporarily delayed due to an unforeseen circumstance, and he indicates he'll be here shortly, so we'll expect him to arrive. In the meanwhile, though, if we could get the roll called, Mr. Diodati.
Yes, Member Nichols.
Here.
Member Vardis.
Here.
Member Lucy.
Here.
Member Wallace.
Here.
And Vice Chair Member Gehring.
I'm here. Thank you. All right. So this is the time of the meeting for any public comment to be made. If there is any member in the audience who has an issue they'd like to raise for the committee to consider, please step forward to the podium, give us your name and address, and what the issue you have to discuss might be. And I'm not seeing any last call for any public comment. All right. Seeing none, let's move on to the minutes of September 15th, 2011. Has the committee had a chance to review those? If you have, do you have comments or corrections or changes?
Move to approve.
All right, we got a second. Motion to approve and a second. The one thing I wanted to ask, and I think Mr. Kessler's name is spelled with one S, and I'm getting a nod. So I think we got a misspelling of Mr. Kessler's name with a. It should be one S. With that change, we can approve the minutes. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Looks like we got a unanimous approval. Okay. Operations report. Mr. Coleman, are you going to give that?
Yes, I am.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Ron Coleman, the Water System Superintendent with Public Works. Okay, let's start with Lopez Lake. Lake elevation today was 516.48. It means the storage would be 43,958 acre feet with a capacity of 89.3%. Rain year to date is 2.94 inches. Downstream releases are currently 3.3 MGD, million gallons a day. Elevation compared to the last meeting in September is about 2% lower, just for your info. The water treatment plant, the production currently is 5.0 MGD. State water is currently off. It's been off since November 4th for the annual DWR's annual maintenance. And they'll be back on Monday, November 21st. The staff took that opportunity to convert to free chlorine to help flush and disinfect the distribution system, and some of the agencies, I think, took advantage of that and flushed their main lines also during that time. And that's about it.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Questions for Mr. Coleman or comments? Mr. Nichols.
Yeah, I have a question relating to the power failure that occurred back in August.
Correct.
What has the plant done to avoid that sort of problem in the future?
Well, we're still looking at options on that. We're hopefully looking at some budgetary options, we're looking at getting some consultants, electrical engineer consultants, to see if there's some way we can track power dips, power changes coming into the plant, maybe possibly some equipment to prevent surges, monitor or prevent water power surges, looking at possibly some instrumentation or programming personnel. Programming was a big concern because we lost all the programming and we don't have programmers on staff, so it took a number of days to get it reprogrammed. So there's a few of those options that we're looking at.
Do we not have a backup system for that program?
There's not a standalone backup system for that. No.
Could we not have that?
That's something that would be looked at also. But there isn't. And I wish the chief plant operator is here. He's more up to date on the SCADA system. But we'll be looking at if there's a possibility or not, or some components or portions of that to be backed up.
Can we get some sort of date that we can get a response to getting some sort of a backup system so that this does not happen in the future? The plant was down for what, 6 days?
It was 6 days, right. Right, but it was a number of things. We lost the power supply to our membrane system, so it was a component mechanical part that malfunctioned, and then we had to replace that, and then we had the programming issues that came up. Right.
And what you consider several options to avoid that?
We will be
situation happening again?
We are looking at several options to minimize that. I don't know if you can completely avoid it, but we're definitely looking at options to minimize that downtime, you know, having additional spare parts on the shelf. And the programming thing is the big issue.
Can we request some sort of a report within a time frame, a reasonable time frame? I'm not sure what a reasonable time frame would be.
I believe a report is in the works for the next, by the next meeting, by your next meeting. There's
okay. That's good.
Okay. Thank you for that, Mr. Vargas. Something.
I have no comments.
Ms. Lucy.
No. Thank you.
No. Mr. Wallace.
Just a minor grammatical thing, Ron. At one point, we were putting the time elapsed percentage against the Lopez and the State Water, so you don't have to do the calculation by going down to the footnotes, and it would be nice if you could put the time elapsed in the titles there to show that, for example, in October it's 58% of the time of the rain year, and on State Water it's 83% of the time of the time lapse.
John, can you point that? What are you referring to, John?
The footnote down below that really talks to two different time periods for the water year for Lopez and State.
In the monthly report?
Yeah.
What page is that on?
It's just 101. It's your table with a graph on it. I thought that you were doing that for a while. It would just be handy rather than trying to make the calculation to compare the total usage on the various systems against time elapsed in the water year.
Okay, shoot that by me again.
For example, on the October, the Lopez water deliveries would be, in the terms of the water year, be 58% of the time elapsed. And we've used 44.7% of the water. So it means that we're okay. I mean, we've not used the full amount of water for the total time. On the state, we're at 86%, and the time elapsed on the state system is 83% because you count that from January.
Correct.
And the Lopez is counted from April.
Right, that's correct.
So it's not a big thing. It just would help not to have to do the calculation to compare against the usage.
We'll see if we can't make that correction.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And did that discussion raise anything else in the minds of the committee members? Anybody else have any questions or concerns they'd like to raise? Yeah. Seeing none, how about anyone in the audience? Anybody have a question they'd like to ask Mr. Coleman? Mr. Coleman, with regard to that power failure problem, the UPS that went out, mm-hmm. did we locate a spare? So do we now have a spare on hand?
We got two at the time. We have a spare on hand.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Apparently they have a shelf life of 4 years, and you still got there's still a few issues, but we ordered two at the time.
It's like a battery.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. And by the way, you did cover dam storage and creek releases. We're done with A and B there, I think. Right. All right. Thank you. All right. Updates. Pavel, I think you're up. Mr. Ogren.
Chairman Gehring, members of the committee. Yes, Pavel Ogren. I'm going to do a couple of the updates just because I've been involved in them a little bit more than I normally am on Zone 3 items. The emergency releases for storm damage reduction is the issue that the board directed us to work with Zone 3 and the Technical Advisory Committee on. And so I attended the last Technical Advisory Committee, but What it relates to is the flooding issues that we've had down in the Oceano area. And considering the storage levels in the reservoir right now, that as we proceed through the winter season, might it be wise at certain points in time to release water from the reservoir in advance of a storm or when conditions warrant as a way of hopefully mitigating risks of flooding downstream. And, you know, we had a good discussion with the Technical Advisory Committee, got some good feedback. And the basic idea of this update is just to simply, you know, make mention of it, say that we'll be looking at it. Obviously, we understand the concerns of Zone 3 in terms of retention of the maximum amount of water behind the reservoir for water supply purposes. Ideally, and this would be hard to predict, we'd see a scenario where we can release water before a storm, and then the storm brings us right up to the spillway level, but we don't actually spill any water. So it's a tough type of a situation to really analyze under what kind of scenarios, and it's got to be just working through the winter season, but in being in contact with you know, the Technical Advisory Committee. And then I think that the big thing that I recall coming out is that to the extent that we might do something like that, then it should have a positive relationship to the surplus water calculations. And the idea is that any water delivered to municipalities while the dam is spilling don't count against deliveries for the purposes of surplus water deliveries, and it helps to increase the amount of surplus water. I mean, it doesn't count for municipal water, and it helps to increase surplus water that's available in the subsequent years. And so we agreed with that, and, you know, and working through the year and then coming back and making surplus water declarations in a subsequent year, that in the event that that happens, then it will help make more water, surplus water, available to all the Zone 3 advisory committees. And that's sort of a confusing discussion maybe, but that's the best I got. Jim might be able to help out a little.
What do you see as your next step in that regard, Mr. Ogren?
I think it's just simply, you know, monitoring the changes in elevation of the reservoir as we're seeing storm events coming in, and whether or not there's a scenario where it might make sense. At this point in time, we wouldn't want to make any releases because, you know, there's no short-term forecast of any significant rainfall. As Ron reported, we're just under 90%. So, again, we want to see water levels increase. And, again, the basic direction from the Board of Supervisors was that to work with Zone 3, that if the opportunity comes up to try to make some pre-releases to mitigate downstream possible flood damage, then let's try to figure it out. But other than that general direction that we're working under, it's hard to identify a specific scenario other than, you know, again, maybe we're up at 97% capacity, there's a storm coming in, we're already monitoring inflow, we know the reservoir's coming up, and you know, we might see an opportunity to make some releases.
Mr. Nichols. Do you have any idea what volume of rainfall it takes to raise the level on a percentage basis?
We certainly have a lot of different hydrological data for the reservoir. And the thing that's interesting in, well, first off, obviously, I'm not that type of an expert, but I have reviewed the data a lot in the past. In fact, in decades past, when Clint Milne was the county engineer at the time, he sat down with me and actually showed some unique features about Lopez. One of the ideas is that in a year like this, when the prior year was really wet, we can expect that we're going to have a lot more runoff in just normal storm events. That is an indication that, you know, we have deeper canyons. They're probably filled with a lot more debris. There's more, you know, it's probably already got a lot of saturation just from the last year. So the thing that's interesting about Lopez is there's a multiple-year saturation factor involved. So all, you know, we can say is that it's not like a watershed where there's always a linear or direct correlation between rainfall and runoff. We just know that in a year like this, we can expect that with some good storms that we may have a lot of runoff. You know, off the top of my head, though, I can't quote that with a 3-inch rain over 24 hours, we should be able to expect, you know, a range between X and Y in terms of of runoff and stuff. But we know that the watershed can be very responsive. Just the year that it was built in 69, you know, it went from zero to full in 3 months and everything. So clearly those kind of scenarios, there's no level of releases that we're going to have that will prevent, you know, a large spill from happening.
Under those circumstances, then, what are you going to use for criteria if and when you believe that you should drain some water out of the lake? I mean, you're approximately 90% full right now.
Right.
If somebody says we're going to have some rain Friday, which I believe they've already said, what does that do to you?
Well, okay, so for this Friday, we're not really evaluating any potential downstream releases. Because one is the storm projections aren't expected to be significant. And
what is significant?
Well, like last year, we had 6 inches in about 48 hours.
Yeah.
That's significant.
Okay.
Multiple storms stacking up behind each other, that's significant. You know, but a one-inch rain, and if we get a one-inch rain or a two-inch rain right now or something that's a moderate type of a storm, and we can start then seeing what kind of runoff that we're going to get or what kind of elevation changes we're going to see this year, then that's going to give us a better ability to start predicting what this winter is going to look like. But that type of storm and that kind of data just hasn't happened for us yet.
So if we're at 90% full, right, and the weather prediction on the rain coming up was we can expect approximately 2 inches of rain from the coming up storm.
Yeah,
that doesn't tell you that we're going to have 91% or 99%.
Not yet, but if we get that 2-inch rainfall and we see the reservoir go from 90% to 94%, then we know, you know, how it's going to respond this year, and we'll have a better ability then to adjust to subsequent storms.
And what is the flow, outflow, if you were to want to release water out of Lopez Lake? How fast can you release water out of there?
I think that I'm hearing about 200 CFS. And I was seeing if Ron was still here. But that 200 cubic feet per second is about what I've
heard. What is that?
200 cubic feet per second is my recollection, which would then translate into a million gallons a day. So that's 3 acre feet. Something.
What does that correlate with percentage? If you were to release water for 24 hours, percentage-wise, how much are you going to lower?
In a 24-hour window, we're not going to be able to reduce storage in the reservoir significantly. It's not a flood control reservoir like Nacimiento is, where they can release 25,000 cubic feet per second.
That's part of my point. It's not a flood control lake.
Right.
And I'm not sure that you can use it as a flood control lake.
And that's also in responding to the Board of Supervisors, we were making sure to, you know, we reemphasize that point, that the dam itself, it does have flood control benefits because it will capture storm flows, and then those storm flows are metered out essentially through the spillway. So any reservoir is going to have some degree of flood control protection. But it's not designed like Nacimiento is to, you know, make significant releases like that in preparations of storms. And that's why, you know, I sort of preface the comments is that there might be very limited opportunities here. And so we're going to just work through the winter and work through the technical advisory committee and sort of play it by ear a little bit. But and part of it, it's responding to the, you know, again, general direction of the Board of Supervisors to work with Zone 3, see if there's opportunities to help mitigate downstream, you know, potential flooding events. And so, you know, we've been working with Zone 3, the TAC. And
if you chose and were given the authority to drain portions of the lake at various times, release water, if you will, are you or is the county willing to reimburse the agencies for the surplus water that they will lose as a result of that?
You know, so the point here is, as part of the scenarios, is that we don't want to release so much water that it's going to have a negative effect of the amount of storage. It's the ideal situation where we would end the year right with the water at the level of the spillway, you know, water that would have otherwise spilled, but rather than having it spill in storm events, we would have metered out in advance of storms and mitigated the amount of downstream flows. So what we recognize is that we have an annual commitment to all of the agencies in terms of the contractual commitments on how much water we're going to provide, and the board doesn't want to impair the ability to meet those contractual commitments. So, again, the idea is we're not going to release a bunch of water in order to get a bunch of storage in order to prevent, you know, some situations that are going to be difficult to predict anyhow. And we know that, like in 1969, a big wet year, there's no amount of water we're going to be able to release to prevent a lot of spillage. So we're not going to try to operate it as a flood control facility. We're simply going to see, are there going to be opportunities during the year where it might be wise to pre-release some water while not impairing its safe yield and its ability to make deliveries to the municipalities.
But you didn't answer my question. Is the county ready or willing to pay for the surplus water that the agencies would not get as a result of that release?
Well, obviously I can't make a commitment for the Board of Supervisors, but the answer is we don't want to get to that scenario where it's not the intent to get to the scenario where we're having an adverse effect on municipal water deliveries.
Not the intent, but if you're working on those kind of plans, that sort of a program, then it's a very good possibility that it will happen.
So let's say that we really messed up and something happened, and all of the data would show that somehow we've impaired by, you know, 1,000 acre feet of deliveries to the municipalities. In those types of situations where damages, you know, are quantifiable and certain, what I would anticipate that the county would do would still instead turn to its state water excess allocation and say, how can we work out something to reimburse them in water as opposed to dollars, you know, get them the water supply that we otherwise provided them, promise them.
Mr. Vargas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe the question's already been asked by Mr. Nichols. How do I phrase a question? Do you have a pretty good indication of what the maximum flow rate is downstream of the reservoir that can be allowed without causing flooding? Or
certainly through the Zone 1 and 1A levee system we do. Mm-hmm. And the flow rates vary throughout the levee system. At the pinch point, if you will, I think it's between 2,000 and 2,500 CFS. Where the levees begin, we've got a higher number. I think it's closer to 5,000 CFS. But as you get past Highway 1 and sort of turn that corner, it's more restricted, and I think it's down to about 2,500 CFS.
Okay, thank you. The other question is I'm not sure if it's a charter or bylaws or what type of document, but I would presume there's some type of guiding document for the operation of the reservoir speaks to reasonable operations to try to minimize flooding or downstream damage to properties, if possible, anything to that effect?
You know, not really, because, again, the reservoir was never designed and constructed as a flood control facility. It was originally, you know, designed and constructed as a water resource facility in order to establish, you know, benefits. So our downstream releases have historically been established as sort of 4,200 acre feet per year set aside as part of the safe yield in order to make downstream releases to help with downstream water rights. But the focus has been on water rights, and it's been in the past decade that the additional issues of endangered species have come into the downstream release schedule and stuff. But, again, it's primarily been a water rights facility. It does have flood control benefits associated with that, but that hasn't been part of the historical operations and operating plan, as in the case of Nacimiento. And that's what you'll find with many reservoirs, is that some reservoirs are water conservation or water supply reservoirs, others are flood control, and some are mixed use, and Lopez has been a water supply.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ogren. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for that. Ms. Lucy, anything?
No, I have nothing.
No? Mr. Wallace.
Pablo, were you going to get into the graphs that were part of the operations report about projection on storage? I'm not sure how to read that. I didn't know if Ron was...
I can certainly go back to it, because that was part of the graphs that we had. They've been in the last few I think it's page 2 of 3 of, well, it says page 2 of 3, but let's see. In the operations report, it's about the fourth graph back.
Was this a projection of where we were going to go for this fiscal year?
Well, and it's the one that there's a red line across at 100%, vertical line. Let's see, I don't know if this helps at all.
Yeah.
It's this particular graph.
It's the two graphs, one's a bar chart, one's a line graph.
Yeah, and so the line graph is the one that's useful for me. It explains it pretty well, where the blue line with the square boxes show where we're tracking right now. And then it sort of diverges into three different lines. A line that goes, you know, sort of skyrockets, if you will. And that's the one that would show that if we had a wet year, we would be looking at spilling near the end of December or early January. The second line would say that if we have a normal year, we'd be looking at spilling later in the winter season near March.
Okay, I've got it now. So it's just a projection of where we would overtop the, where we would spill, depending upon whether it's a dry year, average year, or wet year.
That's correct. And the National Weather Service and the various projections are giving about a third, third, third between the different scenarios. So
looking at this on an average year for about 20 inches of rainfall, you're predicting that we're going to spill sometime maybe February-ish?
Yeah, later in the winter season.
Yeah. Okay.
And of course, you know, the prediction of a dry year shows that we'd actually see reservoir levels slightly going down, in which case, if that's what things track, then we're not going to be making any pre-storm releases or anything.
Okay, got it.
I guess the question I have, Mr. Ogren, actually I have a number of them, but the first one that comes to mind is the staff time that would be spent to analyze and decide when to make these releases and to control the releases. These would all be, well, who would be paying for that staff time?
It's a good question, and I think the argument is that it should not be Zone 3 operations, right? So we'll make sure that that's true.
The next question I have is in regard to helping out Oceano, which is certainly everyone would be in favor of. I'm under the impression, perhaps incorrectly, that the only way Zone 3 would affect Oceano would be that if there are high flows in Arroyo Grande Creek, those high flows would tend to close the flapgates, which would allow draining the lagoon.
No, I think that the relationship between high flows in AG Creek and the closure of the flapgates is what we've evaluated is that the closure of the flapgates is more likely when there's a high tide condition combined with a storm surge, and then Arroyo Grande Creek is flowing high. But because there is a limitation of around 2,500 CFS in the middle of the channel, if the tides are out or if there isn't that combined storm surge, and also if we've got a free flow to the ocean, if the sandbar is already breached and it's been open for most of the year, that the constriction is really within the middle of the levee system. So the concern is that we've got a good storm event and the natural flows through the levee are already pretty high, and then it starts to spill, and that's just enough to put it over the top of the levees. We also recognize that there's always the probability or possibility that the levees are going to overtop even if Lopez doesn't spill. You know, the storm event that could come down Los Barros Creek could itself be sufficient to exceed the capacity of the levee system. That was a storm event coming through Los Barros in 2001 combined with a log getting stuck in the side of the levee is what caused the breach in 2001, and Lopez wasn't spilling at that particular time. So like any common watershed, there's a combination of many different factors, and a potential spill of Lopez is just one. And so, you know, when you've got that multiple variable equation, you know, the board just said work with Zone 3 and do the best you can kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect segue into my next question. In terms of working with Zone 3, my recollection is the technical committee was a little uncomfortable with the concept, and I guess I'm thinking that what you mean by that was that you would at least consult with the technical committee before making such releases?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the last but not least is that I also thought I heard that there will be some way of making us whole with unallocated state water if something happens?
Well, let's say we make a little bit of pre-storm releases and Lopez still spills. Well, then, you know, the reservoir still fills up. And then the question just is, when we make those pre-storm releases, any of the municipal deliveries should not should be factored into the surplus water calculation as though they were occurring during a spill event. And that way we're not jeopardizing the surplus water calculation.
Okay, and then finally with a really last question. you'll recall that when Mark Hutchinson developed the interim downstream release schedule, that there was that schedule before it was implemented required quite a lot of study of the creek, the installation of gauges, and quite a lot of data had to be developed. And I'm thinking that before the reservoir can be effectively operated in any kind of a flood control mode, that perhaps that level of study is also necessary.
Yeah, I think that we probably don't agree, because what that was study was really focused on, and I made sure to consult with Mr. Hutchinson, is minimum flows in the creek in order to maintain a habitat for endangered species. But we don't see that in the opposite situation when we're pushing out a lot of water. The one situation that we would be concerned is that if the lagoon down at Arroyo Grande hadn't breached already and wasn't flowing open to the ocean, then we would be hesitant about making a bunch of pre-storm releases to essentially cause it to manually breach, because then, you know, there's a sort of a, rather than taking a tractor out there and breaching it, we're using water to artificially breach it. So that particular situation I would be concerned with. But as long as the creek is free-flowing to the ocean already, which we believe it would be before we got into this type of a scenario, then, you know, I think it would just be part of normal operations of the dam and what's acceptable, versus on the Idris issue and everything that was, again, addressing minimum flows for habitat and endangered species purposes.
Actually, I was actually kind of going to some of the questions that Mr. Nichols raised, and that is that if we have a better feel for how the reservoir rises with regard to antecedent moisture conditions in the soil and then the size of the storm we expect, if we have a better feel or some sort of a program set forth, then you could perhaps logically be more firm in the way you would make releases.
And I agree. And our problem right now is that we just haven't had rain this year to see how the reservoir levels are going to respond to actual storm events. So the storms have got to happen, and then we've got to start doing a bunch of calculations and seeing what we might be able to figure out for the year, because it seems to be it's very year specific.
Okay, and did that conversation raise any other questions?
No.
Mr. Nichols? No. Mr. Vardis? Ms. Lucy? Mr. Wallace?
Just one final. With the Zone 11A stuff that's just been completed, what's the evaluated frequency of protection for the channel as it sits today?
Less than 10 year.
Okay.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons we're concerned. Okay, so what I'm taking out of today's meeting is that we will make sure that costs that we incur as a result of doing these calculations and looking into this issue will not be charged to Zone 3, because it's not a Zone 3 operating charge. In addition, as we get storm events and we have some actual data to work with, when we do the calculations, we'll quickly send out those calculations to the technical advisory committee members so that they are also in the loop in understanding how storm events are affecting elevations in the reservoir. And those would be our next two steps, I think.
Very good. Thank you. And before we leave that particular subject, is there anyone in the audience who has any question or comment for Mr. Ogren or the committee? Seeing none? All right. And Mr. Ogren, I think you have another item here.
They do. And Mr. I'm sort of going to give a little bit of a preview on this particular item to some of the discussion that Mark is going to have on the HCP status.
But because the water availability analysis that the Department of Water Resources recently said, hey, we need to start working on water availability analysis, is something then that I was up in Sacramento a week ago Monday, and so I requested a meeting with State Water Board staff to talk through the issue. In your board package today also, Dean had responded to a previous request that had first generated at the Technical Advisory Committee. And County Council, even though they don't always, usually do not authorize release of their legal opinions, did authorize the release of this legal opinion in terms of the legal basis for the State Water Board to require a water availability analysis. So Tim McNulty with County Council's office is the one who is he's sort of number three in County Council's office, and he provided that particular legal opinion that said, yes, clearly State Water Board staff has the ability to ask us or require us to do a water availability analysis. Also attached within the package itself are State Water Board's guidelines on how to do a water availability analysis, which I don't really intend on getting into that type of a detail today. But the idea is then utility staff turned to Stetson's Engineering and said, what's it going to cost in order to do a water availability analysis? And in general, the idea is the hydrological information needs to be documented to show that, in fact, there's water available to store behind a reservoir so that we're not going to affect down other people who have water rights. And that type of analysis has always been required associated with dam types of operations. Also incorporated in there is this issue of the public trust doctrine, which is why we're having to do the HCP. And so we got a proposal back from Stetson Engineering that was something in the order of magnitude of $50,000 in order to do a lot of different work. And when we looked at it, we're like, okay, let's see, how do we want to approach this project? So I sat down again a week ago Monday with State Water Board staff and wanted to talk to them about the scope of approaching this analysis, knowing that it was required, because there's a couple of dynamics that are going on. One is certainly when the dam was originally constructed, this hydrological data was already developed. It should be a lot of, we shouldn't really have to develop a lot of new data. And they agreed, and they really pointed to a certain table in the HCP and said, if you could just get us the data behind this table, then we'll figure out how to get it in a worksheet and work with you, because we don't really think that this overall scope of work requires a consultant and $50,000 worth of work. And so that's the first message, is the State Water Board staff said, look, we're not asking for that big of a thing. We can get focused. We know this dam's been around for a long time. If you can get us the data behind here. So our staff is going to go up with Stetson to Sacramento, start walking the State Water Board through all of our existing data in order to try to get to a shortcut on getting them what they need under that component of the water availability analysis. Then to the extent that there's another component where we have to identify downstream water rights, because in the issue of how much water is available and how much are we going to store behind the reservoir, we have this burden of proof that we're not negatively impacting existing water rights. Now, because of the operation of the dam for the last 30 years, we know that that's true. But the documentation side of it then, as I said, well, State Water Board, you're the ones who have all the documentation on downstream water rights. So my preference is that you educate our staff on what that is when we're up here in order to make it more cost-effective. And they were agreeable to that. So in terms of actually getting this water availability analysis together, sitting down with State Water Board staff, said, hey, I'll get our people up there, walk you through the data so we can be efficient there. And I want you guys to walk our staff through the water rights data so we can, you know, to help us with being efficient on that point, and they were agreeable. So that's all pretty much good news and something that, you know, we need to work together with State Water Board staff on and getting to those conclusions. The other side of it is the water availability analysis ultimately says, what is it that we're proposing to do in the HCP in comparison to downstream water rights? And there's a test in there that perhaps we didn't recognize earlier, and that is that now that the downstream release regime that we're getting some positive feedback from Anthony Spina and National Marine Fisheries on it. Well, that's good. We know Anthony can't approve it. It's got to go through the federal process and everything, but we're getting that positive feedback from him. And so it's through this water availability analysis that the comparison of those releases to downstream water rights is going to be accomplished to make sure that releases under the HCP do not have a negative effect on downstream water rights, because so far as an HCP, we want to make sure that it's addressing the needs of steelhead and endangered species, but we can't forget about the water rights of downstream users. I also kind of got into the next question of the areas where we could find ourselves with some discomfort at the local level, because I think you might recall in March when Anthony was here, we asked Anthony about, well, okay, you know, if Zone 3 is doing this stuff to address endangered species, who works with the pumpers of the water downstream? Because if somebody else is drying up the creek, then, you know, we can't be held accountable for that. And Anthony indicated that, well, that was his job to work directly with the farmers, and exactly what that means is up to interpretation, but he recognized it was his responsibility. So I posed the same question to the State Water Board, that if we go through our renewal of water rights and we've sufficiently addressed the HCP issue, and then something happens downstream, what's your position on it? And they also recognize that from a water rights perspective, that it's their responsibility, that once they get through our water rights, if there's something that of a riparian nature, historically riparian meant, if you got the property and there's water there, you can pump it. But again, if that kind of pumping operation would affect public trust doctrine and endangered species issues, then it's really on the water rights side for State Water Board. So, you know, their position is similar to Anthony's position, which is with respect to downstream water rights and downstream pumpers, it's really their responsibility. But I also recognize that in terms of the HCP and making sure we understand water rights, I want to make sure that County Public Works sees the situation so that if we get into the discussion with the growers or the other pumpers, that, you know, we're sort of all on the same page and we're not getting at odds with each other. So bottom line, it was a productive conversation. The timing of it is, you know, we're going to be up in Sacramento, if not before the first of the year, soon thereafter, to take next step with State Water Board staff. And in the update to the Technical Advisory Committee, the issue was is that we'll work with Stenson on revising their scope of work and bring it back before we recommend approval of it.
All right. Thank you for that. Mr. Nichols, any questions, comments?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to phrase it. Even I recognize that hindsight is 20/20. But I have been a little concerned. This HCP has been going on for a long, long time. And it's cost a bundle of money. And looking at this report, I note that Water Code Section 1260-1266 specifically states, item K, sufficient information to demonstrate a reasonable likelihood that unappropriated water is available for the proposed appropriation. So it seems to me that we knew about the water availability requirement a long, long time ago, and it appears that it was kind of overlooked until just recently. And I'm kind of curious as to how that happened and maybe why it happened. And
so I asked the State Water Board staff the same issue, and that's the idea that back in the 1960s, the water rights permit was approved. And there's two aspects. There's diversion to storage and then direct diversion. And it has the issue of that's the relationship of how fast are you using the water. And so it was supposed to have both diversion of storage and a direct diversion in the permit. So our revised application is asking for both. And, you know, I just asked State Water Board, wasn't that just as much an oversight of State Water Board in the 1960s as anybody else? And they're like, yeah, you know, in the 1960s, the stuff was looked at and everybody knew it was good and, you know, no one paid attention to the language in the permit. So, you know, it's stamped and it doesn't – and it sounded to me like – this was not a unique situation that, you know, the articulate writing of the water rights permits has been less than perfect in many cases. So that situation of knowing we needed to get the language of our permit revised and perfected, if you will, is one thing. But the separate issue of the public trust doctrine and addressing endangered species is independent of the imperfected nature of the water rights, because like in the case of Mono Lake, which is the precedent, is that when any dam or virgin or water rights permit doesn't adequately address the public trust doctrine, then the courts have said to the State Water Board, you've got to do it in order to revise the permit. Now, it's happening to us, and in the other discussions with the State Water Board, the question was, well, then under the public trust doctrine, could that also have an impact on the water rights of downstream users, all the permits along the creek? And the answer that they said was, yes, it could, that it's not just the water rights permit associated with Lopez Dam, but it's the water rights permits associated with the entire creek, because endangered species of steelhead are, you know, prevalent throughout the entire water body. What Mark will talk about then is that while he's developed milestones on next phases of the HCP, some of it is going to continue to depend on how complicated does this situation continue to go. And then what our recommendations on a fiscal perspective is simply that we maintain the existing level of funding that's been in the Zone 3 budget for the last couple of years. It's actually at a lower level of funding than if the HCP had been approved, and I'll let Mark walk through that. But to the extent that we get costs, you know, in the future years beyond it, then we'll work with the reserves, and that way we don't see volatility in the billings to everybody. And we've got adequate reserves from prior to the seismic project that can help to at least mitigate any fiscal issues.
All right, thank you. I'll save my others till
later. Okay. And Mr. Vardis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Ogren. Two questions and a comment. First question is, and I think there's maybe a statement, certainly portion to the fact, and maybe this is a question for Mark, but to what extent does the project description, in quotes, or flow regime that's been developed as part of the HCP process reflect the information or considerations that would be looked at as part of this water availability analysis? And what is the potential that, based on the findings of the WAA, could affect the current flow regime within the HCP and the extent to which that needs to be modified?
So that's one of the reasons why I'm looking into it, because the scenario, and Mark will be able to quote numbers out of the HCP and the flow regime better than I can. But in wet years and normal years, I don't see any risk, because in wet years and normal years, we're going to have enough water in order to make downstream releases under the HCP that are also sufficient to meet all of the water rights downstream. It's in the dry years that the concern exists, because part of the general theory is that in the wet years, we release a little bit more water in order to help increase the population of steelhead so that they have a better chance of surviving during the dry years, because in a natural condition, we know that in dry years the creek is going to dry up, and if there's healthy populations to get through drought years, then the long-term survivability is going to be better off. But in that flow regime right now, the risk is that in dry years, even though we've cut back down on downstream releases for environmental, have we cut back on them too much, and therefore we're having a negative effect on downstream water rights? That's the question out there. It might also be, since flows are so low at that point in time, the State Water Board just says, okay, no, that's good, and to the extent that it has some marginal impact on downstream water rights, that's their contribution to the public trust doctrine and endangered species. So the risk is in dry years. Again, I'll let Mark talk about the actual calculations associated with it. But even in that situation where we say, hey, we got 5 CFS and we're only releasing 3, so we're keeping 2 CFS in dry years, and downstream water rights might say, hey, got to release it all because, you know, we have a water right. Well, the State Water Board might still turn around and say, no, you know, that's going to be in those dry years your contribution to the public trust doctrine. So we can quantify we still don't know how State Water Board or federal agencies might make their decisions and stuff.
Thank you.
That's the risk.
Thank you. In regards to looking at the cumulative flows and what the effect is to downstream water rights, or what is the cumulative effect or impact to public trust resources, such as Steelhead or Tidewater Gobi, or potentially something else, would the State Board's interpretation of those public trust impacts, and if their finding is that there needs to be some type of ratcheting back, is that ratcheting back, is it based on kind of like a per capita contribution or effect, or do they look at riparian water rights being senior and that appropriative rights or the Zone 3 rights would have to be curtailed first? Or is it just based on strictly what is the withdrawal or incremental contribution from the different users and how much each of them has to pull back? I don't know if that question makes sense.
Well, it does in a general sense, because in a general sense I tried to pose the same question to State Water Board staff, which is how might the State Water Board evaluate public trust doctrine issues? And the general sense that I get is that when we walk through the HCP process, and then when the permitting agencies, you know, National Marine Fisheries for Steelhead, and if we get into the Tidewater Gobi, then I think that's Fish and Wildlife, but when the HCP goes through its process, the idea is that the HCP has addressed the public trust doctrine. And so then the State Water Board can say public trust has been adequately addressed, and therefore we are then incorporating those findings into our state water permit. So it's not anticipated that the State Water Board is going to go into a lot of deliberations on the public trust doctrine, because that will already have been addressed through the HCP.
Thank you. And that was kind of going to be my comment, was that a little bit of experience that I've had with water rights and the environmental review is the hinchpin, or it gets tied up, is when the resource agencies respond and ask for these additional analyses. And the benefit to us is that you've already been going through these levels of analyses in coordination with the agencies through the HCP process.
Right.
So that's looking at the bright side of it.
Yes. Now we're getting State Water Board engaged into the process. And so one of the outcomes of the meeting was that we invited State Water Board staff to the upcoming meeting that we're going to have with the resource agencies to talk about the HCP, so the State Water Board staff can start getting up to speed on the efforts on the HCP.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that. Ms. Lucy, anything? Yeah, Mr. Wallace.
Yeah. Finally, Pablo, just a question. I know that we probably are way beyond this argument, but clearly when we made the application for a permit, we intended to have, as part of that permit, diversion to storage. And it seems like it's more of a grammatical error in the way that they wrote up that permit than it was a conscious decision to exclude that at that point. And, again, I guess we're paddling upstream and way past that argument, but it seems like we could make a strong argument that it was just a technical grammatical oversight in the way they wrote up that permit.
Well, and I believe that to be true also, but that argument is not going to relieve us of the obligation to address the public trust doctrine and the HCP.
But it would eliminate perhaps some of the protests that have been filed.
Yeah, that's what we don't believe it would do.
Well, it seems like it would, because that was the basis of their protest.
They might have used that as an angle, but again, my understanding of the Mona Lake case is it was just simply a public trust doctrine, and it was a case where, you know, the federal courts decided that, hey, State Water Board, it is your obligation to address public trust doctrines in the issuance of water rights permits. It's also my understanding of why downstream users could be subject to public trust doctrines even if they have riparian rights.
I guess the corollary to that argument would be, had the state recognized diversion to storage in our original permit and specifically identified it, would there have been any protests that would have been valid?
And so our understanding is that those protests still would have been considered by the State Water Board,
okay,
and we still would have been down that path. you know, in working with county council, now that we're at this particular phase, we've identified two things that we want to make sure to do in order to move forward. One is both Water Rights Council and HCP Council.
Pavel, I'm under the impression that we were going to hear from county council on the issue of our existing water rights permit in November, and we're already getting late into November.
Okay, so I might have a misunderstanding, because my understanding was the legal opinion on the water availability analysis and how that works into the water rights permit. Maybe you can help me out on, question of just the ability, or just the basic issue of what John was addressing there?
Yes, and there's a rather lengthy email that I sent to Dean Benedict's quite some time ago that addressed a number of those issues, and last time I talked to Dean about that, he assured me that the opinion we see in the staff report tonight was not addressing that issue as yet.
That's correct, and I had two separate conversations with two different members, you know, Tim McNulty on the HCP and legal counsel, to make sure that we helped push that along, and then with Warren Jensen about the need for broader ranging water rights, not just but Zone 3, but it's one of those, to get into that level of detail on a specific topic, and I think we'd have to be looking to independent water rights council to get there. You know, in terms of reading the statutory requirements of the water code and the type of legal opinion that Mr. McNulty provided, that's one thing, but I'm not sure that obviously, we have an extremely competent county council, but the level of detail of, like, the Mono Lake precedent and that kind of stuff.
Well, maybe that issue could come back to technical committee to make sure we're communicating on that.
Certainly.
Then last but not least, from my perspective, is what's happened with H.T. Harvey and Associates in their study? I thought we were going to get a report from them, and we haven't.
So, and that is where Mr. Hutchinson is going to talk about the HCP status.
All right. Okay. Does that raise any other questions on the part of committee members? Mr. Nichols?
I do have one more question on the summary that was prepared under water availability analysis as an example. You have stated that the work days is going to be 285. And the target date of November of 2012. And that goes along with the other schedules that we have that don't seem to have any specific dates as to when some of these things are going to be completed. Is there any way that we can start getting some specific goals or targets that can actually be stated, so that we have some sort of guideline to go on?
Well, those milestones right now, and again, that's part of Mark's item on the HCP status, are the best milestones that we have right now. And I think part of Mark's discussion will be including the idea that we're going to continue to work on further developing those milestones into more tasks and schedules.
Yeah, I'll wait and talk to Mark then.
All right. Any further questions? Mr. Vargas? No? Ms. Lucy?
Just real quickly, almost all the studies that are conducted funded through Zone 3 and other entities within the county, they do cross your desk, right?
No, a lot of the technical studies don't cross my desk. What ends up happening, you know, obviously Public Works has 180-plus people associated with it. In our review process itself, we've got eight different divisions, and so each division manager, like Dean Benedict's, is the one who's specifically responsible for, you know, the scoping and the work associated with studies and reviewing them. Dean's not even going to review the details of every study, and sometimes it's working with the technical advisory committee where we're identifying issues and making sure to focus. But at first level, it's the division. And then the two departmental managers, myself and Dave Flynn, who's our highest-ranking engineer, we will review the scope of work that the different divisions are working on, and then we'll focus in on what are the critical issues. So, for example, on the water availability analysis, what are the critical issues? It's the hydrological analysis and getting our people to show State Water Board. It's the water rights analysis, which is getting State Water Board to show our people where that's going on. And then it's the comparison of the HCP to water rights and identifying whether or not things are good in order to proceed with the federal process for the HCP. Because what we don't want to do is get into an HCP process where we haven't looked at the water rights side of stuff and conferred with State Water Board, get done with the HCP, and then the State Water Board comes back and says, well, that's a nice HCP, but we're not going to let you impact the downstream water rights. So in terms of managing a large department, the idea that myself and then Dave Flynn is the highest ranking engineer, we look at the scope, we work with the division managers, and we're talking about what are the critical issues so that we gain an understanding of the critical issues and how they're being tackled. Some reports I do work on and I look at more closely, depending on, you know, what the topic is and my level of involvement that I have in a particular issue. So when something like this comes up, then I do get more involved, but I still don't study the hydrological information. I rely on the advice that I'm being provided from people who do the technical work.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Wallace? No? Any other committee members with questions for Mr. Ogren before we move on? And before Mr. Ogren steps down, anyone from the audience with a question or comment on that subject? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Ogren. And I believe, unless I'm off agenda here, it's time for Ms. Brunick to give us an update on the budget. Momentarily.
Good evening. Sorry, I hadn't talked to Mr. Ogren. I wanted to double-check on something before I gave my information. My name is Jenny Brunick, Department of Public Works. First item I will be presenting is the first quarter budget. We're doing pretty well. O&M is under budget by 11% or $89,000. The majority of the savings comes from the water treatment plants section of professional services, labor, and overhead. The second graph represents the non-routine O&M. This is over budget by 64% or $39,000. Oh, I'm sorry, it's under budget. The majority of the savings comes from the Lopez water rights expenditure. I asked on this expenditure when the expenses would hit and was told in the third or fourth quarter of the fiscal year. That's when I'd see more expenses come in. The third graph represents the capital outlay reserves. Capital outlay is under budget by 73% or $247,000. This is due to the water line crossing Rodriguez Bridge and the chlorine dioxide generation system. Again, I checked to see what the status was on both of these expenditure-wise, and was told that the third and fourth quarter budget would reflect more expenses on these two. So overall, Zone 3 is under budget by about 30% for the first quarter, so we're pretty much where we've been historically. And the second item is the final numbers for fiscal year 2010-11. The refund or the credit due to the agencies is a total of $307,897.13. Excuse me. And that will hopefully go out at the end of the month, the credits to each agency along with the invoice due on January 1st, 2012. And that's all I have. If there's any questions.
I'm sorry. I'm lost. Where is that number in the staff report?
No, I didn't put that in there. No. It's a lot of spreadsheets, but I'd be happy to email it to.
So the agencies can expect a refund?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. And then the other question of clarification I had is I got an email update, I think, today on the graphs, and I assume that mm-hmm. that information is the same as what was just handed out?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Questions? No. Mr. Vargas. Ms. Lucy? Yeah. Mr. Wallace.
Jeannie, is the refund based on entitlement or usage?
It's based on the expenditures that were...
No, but I mean, you have $307,000.
Oh, it's based on entitlement.
On entitlement, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, of course...
I just had one question for you. On the you have the court, the narrative in the back, and I, without having my budget with me, are these two items are they listed as expenditures and capital improvements? The dioxide generation system and the Rodriguez water line.
Yes, in the budget, they're in the capital outlay capital outlay section.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions from committee members on that issue, on the budget? How about from the audience? Any questions from the audience? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Brunig.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we are to HCP status. Mr. Hutchinson, front and center.
So good evening, members of the advisory committee. I am Mark Hutchinson. I am the environmental programs manager for the Department of Public Works. And as you can see in my staff report, I'm here to speak with you this evening because we are at a moment, at a point in the HCP where we're transitioning the leadership of the project from our utilities division to the environmental programs division. Dean and his people have worked with the consultants, primarily Stetson, over a number of years, as you know, to develop the downstream release program. That is the key of what we in the environmental business call the project description. Obviously, we've been working along with Dean, although with his division in the project manager seat. We now transition this, like we do with most projects, as we're heavy into the environmental process, into my division. So we've been looking through the project at the downstream release program, at the issues that we look at with all projects, primarily scope, schedule, and budget. The downstream release program certainly is the key scope portion of the document. And then I've taken a shot at the schedule and also provided you with some budget comments. I'll take them out of order just a little bit. Regarding the budget, I noticed in working with our accounting division since the inception of work on the water rights and then subsequent to that the HCP, that Zone 3 has expended an average of about $81,000 a year on this effort. As I look at the next 6 to 12 months in our process, I have in my hand, as you know, a cost estimate from H.T. Harvey in the range of $240,000. I've estimated staff time for Katie Drexage of my staff, whom you know, and myself to work on this in the range of another $70,000 over the next year or so. That's a total of $310,000. In 12 to 18 months, which is an expenditure rate somewhat higher than what you've seen. Added to that, we have the water availability analysis. In conversations with Pavo and through the TAC, it's fairly obvious that we do have reserves in Zone 3 to address that. So we think we can move through the process in the next year or two, working primarily from reserves with the money that's already budgeted, so that there would not be an impact on any rates or charges or any of those sorts of things. I did note, and there is a graph you can see there in the back, of that difference between what has been expended, that's attachment 3, and what it will cost us to actually implement the HCP in its current form. You notice the solid line across the graph, and it's this colored bar chart in the back. The HCP has in it at this point two accounts. It commits to $50,000 a year each to a conservation account and to a monitoring account. There's quite a bit of information in the document about the conservation account, a bit less about the monitoring account. But the HCP does make a commitment to downstream habitat improvements, those that are focused primarily on increasing fish passage without having to increase water flow, which, of course, is Zone 3's interest. That total is about $2 million over the 20-year life. I've estimated just roughly another $50,000 a year to implement both of those accounts and the projects that go with them. I think that's probably a high number, but I think fair for planning purposes at this point. So while we have expended quite a bit of money on this effort, it is interesting to note that it's less than what it would cost us to actually implement the program as it's currently described. And looking at the history, too, over those last few years of the HCP, it's interesting that there's a number of accomplishments that should benefit as we go forward. One that I like to call the Gehring Plan, known formally as the Interim Downstream Release Schedule. We did develop that for Zone 3, and it seems to have been successful on the water side especially. It's kept us out of trouble with the resource agencies. We haven't drained the lake. In fact, I think we've built up some. The more interesting part of that, as I see it, is that it included the installation of a number of stream gauges up and down the creek, primarily those at Rodriguez, also 22nd Street Bridge. We already had Sachetti and Arroyo Grande Creek, and then one we added at Fair Oaks or Valley Road, I think it was. The advantage of those is that we've been actually able to manipulate the release, primarily in the winter when the rain's falling, and observe how the stream responds to that. So we've deliberately made changes in the release flows, both to keep water in the creek for fish, but also to test some of the assumptions in the modeling that's been done to assure ourselves that we will be able to successfully implement that HCP on a downstream release basis. Some of those numbers are quite low, 3 CFS, 6 CFS, numbers like that. So we've actually been quite pleased with the results of the expense that Zone 3 did on the stream gauges in order to put that together and give us a confidence level about the future of the HCP. On the scheduling side, I did take a shot in the staff report on page 3 to establish some milestones. These are targets for Katie and I, and ultimately if we contract with H.T. Harvey with them as well in order to have certain accomplishments done. The challenge, of course, is the water availability analysis and how it may or may not affect our schedule and our project description. In response to that, we've looked at the scope of work for the consultant and the HCP in quite a bit of detail and identified several tasks that can be done independent of the results of the water availability analysis. That's also caused us to take certain other tasks and push them down the road. I think their rough schedule, as the last time I looked at it, working with it, stretched from 8 months after contracting to something like 12 to 18 to accommodate the water availability analysis. Now, if that document and that work is done sooner, then we can speed up that part of the HCP. If it should take longer or cause us to rethink some of the downstream releases, then that would push us out farther down the road. As it shows right now, I think I'm out to May of 2013 to have a submittal draft to the agencies. I think that's a good planning number. We all understand that it could get pushed out, but there's also opportunities there to move that number up if need be. I also took a shot on attachment 1 of your staff report. It is a straightforward black and white bar chart, which is simply the schedule that you've seen before, the post-submittal schedule. That is what happens to the document after it gets submitted to the agencies. In looking at some of the tapes of your meeting, I noted that folks were concerned that on an 8.5 by 11, which we've added just for reference, that schedule is very difficult to read. Page 11, this thing, small print, faded numbers. When you roll up these major tasks, you get the schedule that you see as attachment 1. And that's the one with no dates, of course. That's provided by the agencies to show the sequencing and the relative time frames from one to the other. That's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service primarily at an 18-month process once we submit the document to them. Now, I should say,
before you move on, Mark, just to clarify for me, does that mean that month 1 starts in 5 of 13?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But looking at that 18-month schedule, how should I say, I have my doubts. but that's just the nature of the business. I do want to also point out that there is the CEQA and the NEPA process. The district will be required to produce a document pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act, and I've included on page 6 just that standard chart, try to separate the CEQA-NEPA terms and give us a sense of the complexity and the costs and schedule implications when we go from categorical exemptions all the way up on the NEPA side to an environmental impact statement. At this point in time, we're anticipating that National Marine Fisheries Service will be the lead agency for the NEPA document. That's the federal counterpoint to EIRs that we're used to. They have not yet made a determination on the level of document. We hope to have a conversation or reinitiate that conversation with them next week at our meeting with them. Our argument is going to be that it be something less than an environmental impact statement. Most of us here in this room are used to the CEQA counterpart, environmental impact reports. You've sat on boards and commissions and reviewed CEQA documents. And you might hear from some folks that an EIS and an EIR are essentially the same document. That has not been our experience, especially in the timeframes to process those things through federal agencies. On the CEQA side, I have had conversations with the county environmental coordinator, and that's a specific position in our planning department that's established by board resolution to oversee the CEQA process. They also oversee the CEQA process for the flood control district that we're a part of. The initial conversations with them was leaning towards a negative declaration, and in fact, in a past life, I prepared a mitigated negative declaration for the first draft of the HCP in 2004. However, the environmental coordinators expressed some concerns about how the HCP might impact agricultural interests in the dry years. It roughly parallels the water availability analysis issue with water rights, again, during our downstream release scenarios. So we'll be looking closely at how the water availability analysis turns out and translating that into CEQA terms for the review of our environmental coordinator. Good news on the CEQA side is that we have control over the process and the schedule internally. Typically, my office would write those documents for the review and signature of the county environmental coordinator. Without going on too long, I do want to let your committee know that it is my intention to bring to you regular updates and informational presentations. Some of the topics that I do want to bring, of course, one of the first ones will be the downstream release program. That was prepared by Stetson Engineers. I think the last version is only about 85 pages long. Rather than ask Stetson to come down, it's my intention to do that at our staff level. It is very important for us working on it to understand that document and that program, all the implications, all the ins and outs. And I think one of the good ways for us to do that is to commit to coming and telling you all about it. So that will be one of the presentations that we'll bring. I do want to come and talk to you about the Endangered Species Act. As I stated earlier, we're all primarily familiar with CEQA and how that process works, how you balance CEQA with other interests. I can say that those interests and the way that works and those policies and perspectives are very similar across most environmental laws, but the Endangered Species Act stands apart. So it's important that all of us are on the same page with how that one particular federal law affects things, how it's applied, and how it was written. We do, in fact, have to get out of our CEQA mode when we consider working with agencies and responding and contending with them on that. I want to bring to you a presentation on the post-submittal process, what actually is happening once we hand the document over and it goes into the federal government process. We do have that schedule that Fish and Wildlife presented. They've prepared what's called an HCP handbook. It's a very straightforward 300-page document. So I hope to distill that down into something so that we can track this thing once it goes out of our hands, know where it is, and how we might affect the outcome and especially the pace of review. And then certainly we'll bring to you more information about the HCP itself. We've been talking about the downstream release program for a number of years. You've gotten reports and updates through the TAC.
the work from Stetson. I've just mentioned a couple elements of the HCP that probably haven't been brought forward before, the conservation program, the monitoring program. So we want to bring to you a step-by-step walkthrough of what it is we're preparing and what Zone 3 is intending to submit to the agencies. I wouldn't necessarily do those in that order. We're going to have to just see how things play out. But you can expect to see me back with handouts and slideshows as we move through this process. Pavel mentioned the water availability analysis and what the concern might be with the dry period releases. The straightforward perspective on that is that the HCP proposes different release volumes as a base flow depending on the type of year we're in. Is it a dry year, a wet year, or an extra wet year? And also what the reservoir levels are. Those are the primary components that we'll be using to establish how much water we let out and when we let it out. The other component on that is called attraction flows. Those are just pulse flows that would be released primarily in the wet season. And again, we'll bring these details to you. But what we have is a proposal that says when the reservoir gets low, and I think the number is about 26,000 acre feet, which equates to 2 years of, I think it's 2 years of water supply above the dead pool with a little bit of a buffer. If we were to find ourselves in that situation in the summertime, then there's language in the release program that goes something like this. It says we would release downstream 3 cubic feet per second or the inflow of the reservoir, whichever is greater. No, excuse me, whichever is less. Got that completely backwards. So you project yourself that if we're at 26,000 acre feet of storage, there's been a series of dry years, the valley's dried out, there's 6 CFS flowing into the reservoir in August. We're releasing 3, and a downstream farmer calls up and says, my well is dry. Typically, you'll see releases in the summer of 6 to 7 CFS to counter that effect. So through the water availability analysis, ultimately through the CEQA process, we need to look very closely at that situation and find out where the water rights lie and whether or not we need to modify our release program to address that kind of a scenario. That's really the short answer on the focus concern. For most years, under most scenarios, looking at the amount of water use from the streamside users during the summertime when it's critical, there doesn't seem to be any issues that could crop up. But we'll be able to clarify that through this water availability analysis. So, again, it's our intention to meet with the resource agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, with representatives from the State Water Board this coming Tuesday in Ventura. We will be discussing with them some technical issues of the HCP, but primarily alerting those agencies that we are ready to get serious. Now we have our downstream release program, and they are going to see a document coming forward in the next few months. That's the key component. The other half is to raise with them some specific issues about how the Endangered Species Act and their agencies look at some of the technical details of an HCP in 2011. There's information, again, in their HCP handbook. There was guidance from them in 2002, but things change. So we need to get technical and specific on a couple of issues. I will then take their feedback and the work that H.T. Harvey's done, bring that together, develop a scope with H.T. Harvey and an agreement, and then bring that scope back to your advisory council and show you where we intend to go with the consultant and with the document. So with that, I'll stop and try to respond to any questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you for that, Mark. Mr. Nichols.
Not yet.
Mr. Vargas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson, for the presentation. A couple questions. In regards to the potential for, hopefully not, but if the federal agency, if it's NMFS or the service, states that an EIS is required, is there sufficient information that's been developed at this point to help formulate different alternatives so that they're be able to, or be afforded the ability to do a quantitative analysis of different alternatives?
There certainly is in the downstream release program. Mm-hmm. There's been a number of alternatives worked through with National Marine Fisheries Service, so I think we could certainly do that. There are some alternatives outside of the release program that we would probably have to address, just to document why it is we went the direction we went. And typically in a NEPA document, we have to look at some topics that are what? I would, from a local perspective, we would say the response or the answer is obvious, but going through an entire discussion of why it is that we can't just remove the dam and let the stream run like it did 100 years ago. That's a little bit aggravating to those of us in the local area because we know the answers to those things. But again, in the federal process, you're dealing with folks who look at things literally from a national perspective, so sometimes you have to document the obvious. But it's not a difficult thing to do. The more complex part of an EIS is just simply understanding everything from the agency's internal review process to how terms, our specific terms, are used by that agency in NEPA. Without digressing too much, again, referring back to CEQA, we're all used to how that works. It's a California law. It comes with guidelines issued by the state, which are about three times the size of the statute. The statute's very detailed. Local agencies add a very small amount of information about how we implement it locally. NEPA is upside down from that. The law itself is very short, very brief. The guidelines issued by the Council on Environmental Quality in Washington, D.C. are also likewise short and brief. And then each federal agency is required by regulation to develop their own guidelines on how to implement the law. So NEPA, when you go from agency to agency, is in many ways, and especially at the level that I work at, in the details, a different animal. So one of the challenges, if we were to do an EIS, is to get deeply into exactly how National Marine Fisheries Service looks at this. Minor complication is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service operates under a separate set of guidelines for NEPA. One of those agencies is the Department of the Interior, the other is the Department of Commerce, and that's where the guidelines come down from.
Thank you. You mentioned or you talked about CEQA and that the county, I presume, I think you stated, would be the CEQA lead agency. How would the county be the lead agency? What discretionary action is the county making? And how would the State Water Resources Control Board be involved in that CEQA review?
Well, at the CEQA lead agency would be the Flood Control and Water Conservation District.
Okay.
So I need to use the term district. There is a slight complication in that the district, rather than adopting its own CEQA guidelines, its own environmental coordinator, has simply adopted the same thing that the county did. So you have the county environmental coordinator acting as the district environmental coordinator. But under CEQA law, the agency that either proposes a project or carries out or implements is typically the lead agency, which puts the district in that role. State Water Board does have a CEQA responsibility. CEQA calls that responsible agency, and there's some inside jokes about that I won't share at this point. The difference is that the responsible agency ultimately is not responsible as to whether or not the document is legally adequate. That falls with the lead agency. But everybody on the state side uses the same document. As we prepare a document, though, it's important to work with the state responsible agencies, whoever they are, to make sure that their particular perspective, viewpoint, and information needs is included in the document. And that's done through a formal and informal consultation process. That's also the point probably where the Department of Fish and Game would have statutory influence over the CEQA document. There is a process by which they consult informally with the federal agencies, but their teeth, if you will, of their opinion on things would come through the CEQA process and the state board's action.
Looking at from here to the point of certification of the EIR, some type of action for approval, what do you see as the biggest challenge?
I think it's really just the amount of work that has to be done. This project is unique in a way, and that's why I put the graph in, to show that we find ourselves in a situation where working on the project from the perspective of having water and being fiscally responsible is cheaper than getting it done. I'm not used to that. Typically, we have a goal, we have a bridge to replace, we have deadlines, there's reasons to get it done. So we're not going to do the process that I call throwing buckets of money at it in order to get it done by a certain date. We need to be fiscally responsible. We need to be careful at each step of the process. So, yes, it's possible to hire one consultant for the HCP, a subconsultant to do an EIR, somebody else to help us with the NEPA document, and ram everything through in a very short period of time. But there just doesn't seem to be the justification to carry on at that mode. So really it is keeping enough momentum so that it's fresh, so that it moves through the agencies, which in and of itself is a lot of work, but not be pushing so much so fast and so hard that we're spending money needlessly. As far as hurdles, there are many. I think when we talk about the process, we'll be looking, as I show you graphs and flowcharts, you'll be a little bit concerned about how many landmines there are. But then again, that's why the Department of Public Works has an environmental division. It's our job to go out in the field in front of the projects and turn over rocks and make sure that things are dealt with.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you for that. Ms. Lucy.
I have to go back for a second. Who were you going to go meet with at Ventura? I'm sorry. The acronyms in a foreign language, I'm just trying to catch up with. You know,
so the two agencies that we're essentially applying to for ultimately implementation agreements and incidental take statements are the United States Fish and Wildlife Service,
mm-hmm.
Who has jurisdiction under the Endangered Species Act over red-legged frog and tidewater goby. Mm-hmm. The other is National Marine Fisheries Service,
okay.
NMFS, and we'll say NIMPS. You'll also hear them referred to as NOAA Fisheries,
yeah,
NOAA Fisheries.
Their trainings or updates and stuff.
Same agency.
Yeah, always broke.
So those two will be there. There'll also be State Water Board water rights representatives there.
And you're going to talk to them about the downstream release program that's in place now and that's running on a relatively regular schedule, correct?
We'll identify to them that we have that in place.
And how long have we had that in place?
I'd have to check the dates. It's been 4 or 5 years, something like that now.
4 or 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
We're not being time sensitive here, right?
With respect.
Because I've been listening to the reports, you know, in the downstream releases for at least 3 years, right? So I guess I was a little, like, taken back by, we've had this program in place. They've been doing releases. They've been complying, you know, with the EPA and everything as much as we possibly can. And the program's been in place 5 years. I'm wondering your timeline's for 18 months. So I'm wondering, is that normal, excuse me, that we take so long is to brief them on these programs? Is that a normal timeline? Because I know it's a big program to build. I'm not trying to minimize that at all.
Right.
Right. But it's been up and running. No. I see heads shaking in the background. No.
The thing that we're implementing, the actual document, this interim downstream release schedule,
mm-hmm.
is a document that we prepared in-house with the support of the Technical Advisory Committee,
mm-hmm.
To guide our operators on when we were going to release water and when not.
And we've had that in place how long?
2006 at least.
Okay, so that's been in place for 5 years.
Now remember, that document has not been approved or endorsed or even officially evaluated by any federal resource agency.
But it is practiced.
It is practiced. And the point behind that was to do two things. Keep us from violating the Endangered Species Act by killing a fish, and also not drain the reservoir in the process. So it had some straightforward modeling created. We looked at some historical releases and came up with numbers that we felt would be beneficial to both fish and also keep water in the dam, and it's been successful at this point. Now, remember, we have not been through a dry period with this program in place.
Well, sitting on a board with just the powers of persuasion, thank you very much.
Well, yeah, as Pavel whispers in my ear, the meeting with the resource agencies is about the HCP, the long-term program, the one that they can approve, the permits that we can have in our hands. Because the key, and I'll just shorten it very much, the way we are now, we're releasing some middle releases. We're not doing big releases that benefit fish in the long term by modifying the stream channels the way that things can do. But we're also not operating in the reservoir in a way that would cause us to reduce releases in a series of dry years. The HCP, partly because what we're doing does not necessarily mimic natural conditions, although it has benefited fish, the HCP intends to mimic natural conditions more closely. That means in wet years, more water released. It also means, though, in dry years, sometimes very little released, to the extent that in dry years we could forecast that we will kill fish in the stream. In the big picture, that's a natural phenomenon, and it's good for the population, but legally you need a permit to do that, and that's what we're after.
And you're after a permanent permit or a temp permit to keep on file?
Permanent.
Permanent?
The ACP proposes a 20-year permit at this point.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, one of the questions for the agencies is, might it be more advisable to extend that number and base the extension on an adaptive management program, which is one of those new things that's come along in the last 4 or 5 years?
Years to present the data.
Mr. Wallace.
Just an editorial comment, Mark, and I appreciate utilizing the documents that we've got and the studies that we've already had to be used in the water availability analysis and to curtail some of the costs, and I appreciate that. Just the overall perspective on the time that we've been doing this and when we're projecting to finish, if I understand what your schedule showed, you intend to submit sometime May of 2013, and we would have an 18-month to maybe a two-year period of time for approval after that. So running that on out to 2015 and having submitted this or started this back in 1999, we're talking about a 15, 16, maybe a 17-year process. So I think that's important for everybody to understand the total scope of this thing and why some things don't move faster than they might otherwise think they should. But it's a significant effort over a long, long period of time.
It's not only a tremendous effort, but numbers like those, I think for all of us, are hard to comprehend how something can take that long. Yeah. Yet I look around the state at other agencies, and particularly those that are doing habitat conservation plans or attempting to. I find one on the West Coast that's actually a poor example because it just happened that their operational model matched the HCP best-case scenario. We're also unique, and I'll discuss this at some length with you. When I look up and down the coast at the other efforts, we're talking about rivers that flow, you know, on average 4,000 CFS, 8,000 CFS. So I've commented on some of my colleagues. We're writing an HCP for fish, and our initial problem is we don't have any water. You know? So how are the agencies going to view this? I'm not sure. Part of our effort in working with the agencies is to point out that this is a feather in their cap. That to be this far down in this far south in the state and have an approved HCP that works, and we think what we've been doing over the last 10 years proves that it will work even better than what we've done, should be an incentive to those agencies.
Well, somebody has to be first, and I know that we're maybe breaking a lot of ground here for other folks behind us, but looking at the total cost and the extent of what we're doing over a 16-year period, $3 million for a 20-year permit doesn't make sense. The system has to be streamlined at some point, and I think that's what's frustrated different editions of this committee, because we change. There's a couple careers that go through the county in 15 or 16 years, and it just doesn't make sense for a process like that to be utilized and imposed upon us, although I understand the law and what we have to do to comply. But in the overall big picture, 30,000 feet high, it doesn't make sense.
Certainly is. It raises all kinds of questions.
Yep.
And I hope you can understand that in my position, I kind of have to make a choice to whether I spend the day looking at the big picture from that perspective or whether I spend the day crossing the T's and dotting the I's and moving it forward.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. And did that discussion raise any other questions on any other committee members? I'm not seeing any. And how about the audience? Anyone in the audience have a... Mr. Peralt. He's got a comment or a question.
Just a quick budget question.
Yes. How are we going to pay for this?
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what I had. Bob Peralt, city manager, Grover Beach. Just in terms of what you mentioned with the costs for the next couple of years, I think you mentioned something about $250,000 and then the other costs for staff. I know that the budget line item is $176,000 and the difference will be taken from reserves. I just wanted to know where in the reserves it's being taken from. There's district-funded reserves and there is contractor-funded reserves. And then there's operations and designated, and I wanted to know which one of those is going to be paying the bill.
I just heard a voice behind me that said district.
All right. And then to add to that question, though, will there be a repayment plan? Are we going to reflate those reserves somehow? Or are we just going to permanently deflate them? Mr. Ogren, maybe you can answer that.
As district-funded reserves, they're just simply deflated. It's the contractor-funded reserves that go up and down depending on the annual budgets. The district-funded reserves were established prior to the seismic remediation project. Once the contracts were renegotiated, then the property tax allocation that used to fund district reserves goes to help offset debt service. Those district-funded reserves were established at that point in time, and they do not have new funding sources, and the idea is that they would just simply be used on a very prudent basis as we went through time, and this certainly seems to fit that case.
Okay, thank you for that. That answers my questions. Anyone else? I'm not seeing anything else. And actually, I'm wondering if we'd like to take a little break, like a 10-minute break.
No.
No?
Oh, no.
Okay, AGP, are we ready to go? I got a thumbs up, so I think we're back on the air. We just had a short break, and we were talking about the HCP status. I see Mr. Ogren at the podium with perhaps something to say.
Oh, I thought you were done with the HCP. I was ready to go to the next item.
Oh, you were ready to go to the next item. All right, good. Then please proceed.
So this is the recommendation that was supported by the TAC at the last TAC meeting for up to 250 acre-feet of storage in Lopez Reservoir for non-Zone 3 users included in there. It's a policy recommendation. Before we did anything in detail on that, we'd come back with actual agreements and details. It's based on some of the prior input from Zone 3. It would include a storage capacity fee. it's not the only option that CSA 23 might avail itself to. But in order to keep this component of my discussion short and engage in questions, the item that the TAC then wanted added is the second part of the recommendation, which is the development of emergency storage provisions for Zone 3 contractors. And, of course, that is then altogether consistent with the action that was in front of Zone 3 a year or so ago when we were talking about emergency water deliveries. And so what's one example of how emergency storage provisions for Zone 3 contractors might work? And that's in a given year where all of the county's state water isn't being purchased for whatever reason. We don't usually have everybody buying all their state water. We have a local turnback pool. And in a particular year, then Zone 3 could buy, let's say, for example, 100-acre feet of state water turnback pool, get that delivered, preserve 100-acre feet behind Lopez Reservoir, and then that additional water preserved would be in addition to your normal annual entitlements, whatever surplus water is available, and so it would provide for additional emergency storage just for Zone 3 contractors behind Lopez Reservoir. So, of course, that concept discussed at the TAC we're also supportive of, and that's why the recommendation then is two-part, and be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for that, Mr. Ogren. Any questions? I'm not seeing any. No? Ms. Lucy, any questions?
Well, it's kind of hard to comment on what TAC discussed. It just seems like we get an editorialized version, and so it almost seems probably redundant, any questions I have that were probably already asked in the TAC meeting. So I just was wondering why, you know, 250 acre feet needs to go to Santa Margarita.
Okay, so a little bit of a background is about a year, year and a half ago, before we had this wet winter, Zone 3 contractors were asking for an emergency delivery of state water. Right. And so part of those discussions and the CEQA negative declaration that was developed was the county saying, yeah, we'll help you get emergency water. But at the same time, the county was saying, but can we also, to a very limited degree, work with you all to be able to store some emergency water for other entities in the county in order to try to promote some regional reliability programs? So everybody said yes. They supported the idea. We had a negative deck done. Then it rained, and so the delivery of the emergency water wasn't available. But yet the 250 acre feet is still that program. That component of the program that everybody endorsed is something that the county still wants to move forward with. Now, whether that emergency storage water is actually something that Santa Margarita works into or whether it's somebody else is still up for consideration. It might be that getting emergency water for Santa Margarita, that the better alternative is working with County Ops Center and some of the other state water supplies, or even working with one of the Zone 3 agencies directly, like maybe even Oceano. But the idea of, you know, doing some limited reliability on a cooperative basis with Zone 3 is something we definitely want to see on the table. We think it's good policy consideration because, again, in emergency situations, the more that we're able to kind of work cooperatively to meet people's needs, then the better off we are in the long run. So it's consistent with the prior policy support and work programs of Zone 3. But just Zone 3 didn't have to deliver the emergency water because the rains came.
Thanks.
Chair.
So, what do you want us to do? Just kind of stamp it and move on?
Well, let's see what Mr. Wallace says.
No, I don't have any questions. We had an elaborate discussion at TAC and we're familiar with it. I think it's a good program. Thank you.
Yeah, and I agree with that assessment. So any other questions?
The only question I have is when are they going to sit down and determine what the storage fees would be and other specifics of the program?
So I did some basic calculations. I looked at the annual debt service. Jenny provided me those numbers, and with storage of about 50,000 acre feet, you know, roughly I think the calculation was about $37 per acre foot per year. But again,
we're not asking for endorsement of a specific fee right now. We're just the policy. And then for Margarita, what we're going to, our next step for the Board of Supervisors is to lay out the different options and possible cost implications. And then once an alternative is chosen, if Margarita still has to have their Prop 218 vote, if Margarita approves it, then we'll get into the details of the actual final steps of program development. But the idea is the rough calculation was around $37 an acre foot per year.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. That's all I
have. Okay. Thank you. So unless there are any other questions, I guess we're looking for a motion to adopt staff recommendation.
Also move.
Second.
All right. Any other discussions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Are there any opposed? Must be unanimous. Thank you, Mr. Ogden. Okay, I think, let's see, who's going to handle the new advisory committee representative?
I am.
Okay.
Mr. Gehring. Thank you. This item is to fill the vacancies, the two vacancies for the agricultural member for Zone 3. Mr. Talley had been serving as the alternate member, and there was a vacancy for the permanent member. Mr. Talley expressed interest in becoming the permanent member. In order to do that appropriately, he resigned. And per your bylaws and the MADI Act, we advertised for the two positions, the permanent position and the alternative position. And we received two applications, one from Mr. Talley and one from Varda Kida. So what we're asking for you today is to endorse those two applications so we can take them to the Board of Supervisors for approval with you, your recommendation. And we anticipate doing that in December.
Okay, thank you for that. Both men have excellent qualifications in those regards. I think most of us know them. So any comments, questions?
Are you ready for a motion?
Ready for a motion.
I'd so move that the committee endorse the recommendation to the Board of Supervisors that Mr. Talley and Mr. Akita be the regular and the alternate member, respectively.
I'll second the motion.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Is there any opposed? And Mr. Akita is in the audience. Vard, raise your hand. Yeah, that's who you are. Welcome aboard when the board approves you. All right.
Mr. Talley here?
I don't think Mr. Talley is here tonight.
No, I don't see him.
All right. I think we're on to capital project updates.
Yeah, and I just was going to give a verbal update on the Rodriguez Bridge project. It's currently in 90% design, which should be completed in December. We've obtained all the right-of-way necessary for the project and anticipate the final permit. We have all the permits, but the final permit from Army Corps being finaled this coming March, and that would be timed around going out to bid, and then we're not able to start construction until June. Mid-June, and that's when we would proceed with construction. As far as the emergency plan is concerned, I've been giving you updates at the last few meetings. Our staff has been working with the TAC and per their recommendation to avoid any downtime in sourcing material. We're going to go ahead and purchase the PVC piping necessary to connect the pipeline should the bridge passing creek crossing fail. It's about $10,000 to purchase the PVC piping. That's considerably cheaper than the $35,000 to $40,000 of renting it. And we're looking at about $12,000 in labor should we have a break in the creek crossing.
I have a question about this just from the little bit of information. Have many people driven out there to see that location? I actually had a chance to drive out there this weekend with our inch of rain to see what the environment looked like. And my understanding is that you're going to run ABS PVC piping across the little bridge if the pipe below gives out. Is that the plan?
Yes.
Well, you know, not that being raised in the Northwest has anything to do with my experience with water, but I do have a little bit of experience with water. And I did walk underneath that bridge, and if we're going to get water that's going to take out that little pipeline right there that's crossing there that's shelved. It's got three shelves to it, and the pipe runs through it. It's going to take out that little bridge at the same time, and there goes your temporary thing. It didn't come together for me. You know, I couldn't understand how that would have been a preventive measure. It was almost like putting the emergency backup plan right in the path of the hurricane or the storm in this case. Because I don't think that little bridge is going to hold it. If we have enough water coming down that creek, that's going to take out those tiers of where that, if it's going to take out that right there, it's going to knock that 8-foot bridge that's down another 8 feet right on out.
So our engineer's concerns is that it's not necessarily going to take out that entire casing, but the scouring from that waterfall would cause a bend and a crack, which would then break the pipe. So we're not going to, if there is a break, it's going to be, the concrete's going to stay in place, but the pipe inside will be jeopardized from and won't be able to deliver the flows. Now, if it does take out the entire pipe casing and the bridge does come down with it, either from the concrete taking out the pilings or just the flows themselves taking it out, we've been working with Ready Bridge manufacturer and inventorying what we have already for other bridges up in the North County on hand, and are still working with their consultant to make sure that we have ample material in place should we need to put in a temporary bridge as well, and then strap a pipeline to that bridge. So that is, there's sort of scenario A, B, and C.
I'd love to elaborate a little bit.
What John is mentioning is that there's a manufacturer, Ready Bridge is one of the companies, but it's called a Maybe Bridge, and it's literally a temporary bridge. And it's got like Lincoln log parts. And so when we had to take out San Simeon Bridge number 2 a couple of years ago because it was at a high risk of failure, you know, the crews took it out, and in about, I think it took upwards of 2 weeks in that case, we built this temporary bridge. We're under construction right now for the permanent bridge on San Simeon because we got all of our coastal permits and everything. So we've disassembled the temporary bridge, and it's on site at our yard in Kansas Avenue. But it's one of these things that literally it's neat watching it go up because, if you will, if this is not, I can't lift that up, if it's my finger, and on one edge of the creek, you just start building this thing and you start counterleaving it over the creek. And you have weights on this side so it doesn't, you know, fall into the creek. But soon later, it spans the creek and you set it up on the other side, and it's a temporary bridge. So we've had it on in stock for, you know, literally well over a decade. And it's the type of thing that you put up in an emergency situation. The span that we're looking at for Rodriguez Bridge is a little bit longer than the existing span. So we're getting additional parts, and that's what John was talking about. But that's all part of the roads division's emergency responses and everything. And if that bridge goes out, then it's roads that puts in the temporary one, and it's not a cost of Zone 3.
Well, it's not so much about the cost. It's about, you know, the pipe. And I just think you're putting it on an unstable foundation. If the integrity of the pipe is jeopardized, that bridge is going to be in jeopardy too.
And the point is that we are
anticipating back in its place doesn't make any sense to me versus looking at the plan again and saying, well, why don't we run the pipe this way, or why don't we run the pipe that way, you know, or something like that. I mean, the bridge seemed like the last option when I was out there, and I've been out there 3 times.
Okay, and the concern with the existing bridge is that you've got footings that are getting undermined, and so, yes, we recognize that that existing bridge could get washed out. These temporary bridges, though, have wider spans, and they go further over the banks in order to make sure that, you know, there's plenty of room for storm flows to get underneath them. And then you put the pipe on the temporary bridge. So the point is that we agree with you that we have a concern about that bridge being washed out. And so as a result, we've developed plans in the event that that happens.
Okay. You're the experts.
Mr. Wallace, comment? No. Mr. Nichols, anything else?
No, sir.
No, sir. All right. I guess I'll keep quiet on that. All right. How about future agenda items? Anybody got anything they want to put on future agendas?
Yes.
All right. Let's hear it.
We at one time had some, and I say we, this board at one time had some discussions on the governance of Zone 3. And there was quite a bit of discussion relating to that insofar as this board having a little better handle on decision-making as it relates to Zone 3. That has kind of gone by the wayside, and I'm wondering if we could bring that back and put it on a future agenda. I would like to know if the other members of the board agree with that.
Sounds good to me.
I support that.
I had a question with that. Would that one include decision-making in regard to funding, spending the monies? And
yes.
Okay. I presume.
And that would be mainly policies and procedures and mission statements and how. So it would be mainly a policy discussion?
Maybe we could send it to TAC to determine a scope.
Yes.
Does that sound okay?
That would be a good idea.
It's been before TAC before.
To set a scope, the scope of the item.
Get recommendation from TAC.
My question to you is, has it been before TAC before?
It's my understanding that it was on the agenda for the last TAC meeting at Member Searcy's request, but he was unable to make the meeting because he was sick, and so it wasn't discussed at that meeting. But it should be on the next meeting's agenda, the bylaws and update to the bylaws and review the mission statement.
Not just the bylaws.
And I'm hearing tonight, adding the the spending or governance of Zone 3.
Right. Okay. All right. That sound okay?
Yes, absolutely. Do we have consensus on that?
I think we do. Yeah. All right. Anybody else? Anything else they want to raise for future agendas?
Nope.
I'm not hearing anything. all right.
Just one thing. Can I ask staff that they include in the next packet the letter that OCSD had sent to Zone 3 regarding some of these issues and how it relates to Zone 3's governing persuasion?
Is that something that also could go to the TAC for their consideration?
Yeah, it's at TAC.
Sounds like a good idea to me. All right. Anything else on that issue? I'm not seeing anything, so how about just plain comments? Mr. Nichols? Comments?
No, sir. I have none.
Mr. Vargas? Ms. Lucy?
I just want to thank the county for the work that they've done in the Oceano area in the last 6 months or since the levee broke, really, but in the last, year since last year's flooding, there's been a lot of activity and the levees have been built up and the town is starting to feel a little bit more secure as to which direction our water's going. So we want to thank you for doing that.
Mr. Wallace.
Just to let everybody know that we had an open house at the sanitation district here a month and a half or so ago. And part of that open house tour, we had a brochure that we prepared for identifying portions of the plant and what they do, and a fairly elaborate discussion with pictures inside. So those are available from the sanitation district, and I have a couple copies with me tonight if anybody would like one. But it's really good orientation to what we do there and what goes on at the plant. And Mr. Nichols, as we know, participated in that open house and sits as the chairman of our board there. Just announce that.
Okay, thank you for that. Anybody else? Anything else come up? Okay, so our next meeting will be Thursday, January 19th, 2012, at 6:30 p.m. at Grover Beach City Council Chambers.
We welcome you.
And we're adjourned.
It's too late.
Too late.